Chapter 9. With the money collected at a festa, they usually pay for the dressing of the church, and for the hiring of the band, and for the tapers. If there be any left, which seldom happens, I believe, the souls in purgatory get the benefit of it. They are also supposed to have the benefit of the exertions of certain small boys, who shake money boxes before some mysterious little buildings like rural turnpikes, which usually shut up close, fly open on red-letter days, and disclose an image and some flowers inside. Just without the city gate, on the Elbara Road, is a small house, with an altar in it, and a stationary money box. Also for the benefit of the souls in purgatory. Still further to stimulate the charitable, there is a monstrous painting on the plaster, on either side of the grated door, representing a select party of souls, frying. One of them has a gray mustache, and an elaborate head of gray hair. As if he had been taken out of a hairdresser's window and cast into the furnace. There he is. A most grotesque and hideously comic old soul. Forever blistering in the real sun, and melting in the mimic fire, for the gratification and improvement and the contributions of the poor Janice. They are not a very joyous people, and are seldom seen to dance on their holidays. The staple places of entertainment among the women, being the churches and the public walks. They are very good-tempered, obliging, and industrious. Industry has not made them clean, for their habitations are extremely filthy, and their usual occupation on a fine Sunday morning is to sit at their doors, hunting in each other's heads. But their dwellings are so close and confined that, if those parts of the city had been beaten down by Messina in the time of the terrible blockade, it would have at least occasioned one public benefit among many misfortunes. The peasant women, with naked feet and legs, are so constantly washing clothes in the public tanks and in every stream and ditch that one cannot help wondering, in the midst of all this dirt, who wears them when they are clean. The custom is to lay the wet linen which is being operated upon, on a smooth stone, and hammer away at it, with a flat wooden mallet. This they do, as furiously as if they were avenging themselves on dress in general for being connected with the fall of mankind. It is not unusual to see, lying on the edge of the tank at these times, or on another flat stone, an unfortunate baby, tightly swathed up, arms and legs and all, in an enormous quantity of wrapper, so that it is unable to move a toe or finger. This custom, which we often see represented in old pictures, is universal among the common people. A child is left anywhere without the possibility of crawling away, or is accidentally knocked off a shelf, or tumbled out of bed, or is hung up to a hook now and then, and left dangling like a doll at an English rag shop, without the least inconvenience to anybody. I was sitting one Sunday, soon after my arrival, in the little country church of San Martino, a couple of miles from the city, while a baptism took place. I saw the priest, and an attendant with a large taper, and a man, and a woman, and some others, but I had no more idea, until the ceremony was all over, that it was a baptism, or that the curious little stiff instrument, that was passed from one to another, in the course of the ceremony, by the handle like a short poker was a child, than I had, that it was my own christening. I borrowed the child afterwards. For a minute or two it was lying across the font end, and found it very red in the face but perfectly quiet, and not to be bent on any terms. The number of cripples in the streets soon ceased to surprise me. There are plenty of saints and virgins' shrines, of course, generally at the corners of streets. The favorite memento to the faithful, about Genoa, is a painting, representing a peasant on his knees, with a spade and some other agricultural implements beside him, and the Madonna, with the infant Savior in her arms, appearing to him in a cloud. This is the legend of the Madonna della Guardia, a chapel on a mountain within a few miles, which is in high repute. It seems that this peasant lived all alone by himself, tilling some land atop of the mountain, where, being a devout man, he daily said his prayers to the Virgin in the open air, for his hut was a very poor one. Upon a certain day, the Virgin appeared to him, as in the picture, and said, "Why do you pray in the open air, and without a priest?" The peasant explained, "Because there was neither priest nor church at hand, a very uncommon complaint indeed in Italy. I should wish, then," said the celestial visitor, "to have a chapel built here, in which the prayers of the faithful may be offered up." "But, Santissima Madonna," said the peasant, "I am a poor man, and chapels cannot be built without money. They must be supported too, Santissima. For to have a chapel, and not support it liberally, is a wickedness, a deadly sin." This sentiment gave great satisfaction to the visitor. "Go," said she. "There is such a village in the valley on the left, and such another village in the valley on the right, and such another village elsewhere, that will gladly contribute to the building of a chapel. Go to them. Relate what you have seen, and do not doubt that sufficient money will be forthcoming to erect my chapel, or that it will, afterwards, be handsomely maintained." All of which, miraculously, turned out to be quite true. And in proof of this prediction and revelation, there is the chapel of the Madonna della Guardia, rich and flourishing at this day. The splendor and variety of the Genese churches can hardly be exaggerated. The Church of the Annunciata especially. Built, like many of the others, at the cost of one noble family, and now in slow progress of repair. From the outer door to the utmost height of the high cupola, is so elaborately painted, and set in gold, that it looks, as Simon describes it, in his charming book on Italy, like a great enameled snuff box. Most of the richer churches contain some beautiful pictures, or other embellishments of great price, almost universally set, side by side, with sprawling effigies of maudlin monks, and the various trash and tinsel ever seen. It may be a consequence of the frequent direction of the popular mind, and pocket, to the souls in purgatory, but there is very little tenderness for the bodies of the dead here. For the very poor, there are, immediately outside one angle of the walls, and behind a jutting point of the fortification, near the sea, certain common pits, one for every day in the year, which all remain closed up, until the turn of each comes for its daily reception of dead bodies. Among the troops in the town, there are usually some Swiss, more or less. When any of these die, they are buried out of a fund maintained by such of their countrymen as are resident in Genoa. Their providing coffins for these men is matter of great astonishment to the authorities. Certainly, the effect of this promiscuous and indecent splashing down of dead people in so many wells is bad. It surrounds death with revolting associations that insensibly become connected with those whom death is approaching. Indifference and avoidance are the natural result, and all the softening influences of the great sorrow are harshly disturbed. There is a ceremony, when an old cavalier or the like expires, of erecting a pile of benches in the cathedral, to represent his bier, covering them over with a pall of black velvet, putting his hat and sword on the top, making a little square of seats about the whole, and sending out formal invitations to his friends and acquaintances to come and sit there and hear Mass, which is performed at the principal altar, decorated with an infinity of candles for that purpose. When the better kind of people die, or are at the point of death, their nearest relations generally walk off, retiring into the country for a little change, and leaving the body to be disposed of, without any superintendence from them. The procession is usually formed, and the coffin borne, and the funeral conducted, by a body of persons called a confraternita, who, as a kind of voluntary penance, undertake to perform these offices, in regular rotation, for the dead, but who, mingling something of pride with their humility, are dressed in a loose garment covering their whole person, and wear a hood concealing the face, with breathing holes and apertures for the eyes. The effect of this costume is very ghastly, especially in the case of a certain blue confraternita belonging to Genoa, who, to say the least of them, are very ugly customers, and who look suddenly encountered in their pious ministration in the streets, as if they were ghouls or demons, bearing off the body for themselves. Although such a custom may be liable to the abuse attendant on many Italian customs, of being recognized as a means of establishing a current account with heaven, on which to draw, too easily, for future bad actions, or as an expiation for past misdeeds, it must be admitted to be a good one, and a practical one, and one involving unquestionably good works. A voluntary service like this is surely better than the imposed penance,
not at all an infrequent one,
of giving so many licks to such and such a stone in the pavement of the cathedral, or than a vow to the Madonna to wear nothing but blue for a year or two. This is supposed to give great delight above, blue being,
as is well known,
the Madonna's favorite color. Women who have devoted themselves to this act of faith are very commonly seen walking in the streets. There are three theaters in the city, besides an old one now rarely opened. The most important, the Carlo Felice. The Opera House of Genoa is a very splendid, commodious, and beautiful theater. A company of comedians were acting there when we arrived, and soon after their departure, a second-rate opera company came. The great season is not until the carnival time in the spring. Nothing impressed me so much in my visits here, which were pretty numerous, as the uncommonly hard and cruel character of the audience, who resent the slightest defect, take nothing good-humoredly, seem to be always lying in wait for an opportunity to hiss, and spare the actresses as little as the actors. But, as there is nothing else of a public nature at which they are allowed to express the least disapprobation, perhaps they are resolved to make the most of this opportunity. There are a great number of Piedmontese officers too, who are allowed the privilege of kicking their heels in the pit, for next to nothing. Gratuitous, or cheap accommodation for these gentlemen being insisted on by the governor, in all public or semi-public entertainments. They are lofty critics in consequence, and infinitely more exacting than if they made the unhappy manager's fortune. The Teatro Diurno, or day theater, is a covered stage in the open air, where the performances take place by daylight, in the cool of the afternoon, commencing at 4 or 5 o'clock, and lasting some 3 hours. It is curious, sitting among the audience, to have a fine view of the neighboring hills and houses, and to see the neighbors at their windows looking on, and to hear the bells of the churches and convents ringing at most complete cross purposes with the scene. Beyond this, and the novelty of seeing a play in the fresh pleasant air, with the darkening evening closing in, there is nothing very exciting or characteristic in the performances. The actors are indifferent, and though they sometimes represent one of Goldoni's comedies, the staple of the drama is French. Anything like nationality is dangerous to despotic governments and Jesuit beleaguered kings. The Theater of Puppets, or Marionetti, a famous company from Milan, is, without any exception, the drollest exhibition I ever beheld in my life. I never saw anything so exquisitely ridiculous. They look between 4 and 5 feet high, but are really much smaller, for when a musician in the orchestra happens to put his hat on the stage, it becomes alarmingly gigantic, and almost blots out an actor. They usually play a comedy and a ballet. The comic man in the comedy I saw one summer night is a waiter in an hotel. There never was such a locomotive actor since the world began. Great pains are taken with him. He has extra joints in his legs. and a practical eye, with which he winks at the pit, in a manner that is absolutely insupportable to a stranger, but which the initiated audience, mainly composed of the common people, receive,
so they do everything else,
quite as a matter of course, and as if he were a man. His spirits are prodigious. He continually shakes his legs, and winks his eye. And there is a heavy father with gray hair, who sits down on the regular conventional stage bank, and blesses his daughter in the regular conventional way, who is tremendous. No one would suppose it possible that anything short of a real man could be so tedious. It is the triumph of art. In the ballet, an enchanter runs away with the bride. In the very hour of her nuptials, he brings her to his cave, and tries to soothe her. They sit down on a sofa,
the regular sofa, in the regular place, OP second entrance.
And a procession of musicians enters, one creature playing a drum, and knocking himself off his legs at every blow. These failing to delight her, dancers appear. Four first, then two, the flesh-colored two. The way in which they dance, the height to which they spring, the impossible and inhuman extent to which they pirouette, the revelation of their preposterous legs, the coming down with a pause, on the very tips of their toes, when the music requires it, the gentleman's retiring up, when it is the lady's turn, and the lady's retiring up, when it is the gentleman's turn, the final passion of a pas de deux, and the going off with a bound. I shall never see a real ballet with a composed countenance again. I went, another night, to see these puppets act a play called St. Helena, or The Death of Napoleon. Apostrophe it began by the disclosure of Napoleon, with an immense head, seated on a sofa in his chamber at St. Helena, to whom his valet entered with this obscure announcement. Sir, you out see on low? ...
Yow, as in cow,
Sir Hudson,
that you could have seen his regimentals.
Was a perfect mammoth of a man, to Napoleon, hideously ugly, with a monstrously disproportionate face, and a great clump for the lower jaw, to express his tyrannical and obdurate nature. He began his system of persecution, by calling his prisoner General Buonaparte. ... to which the latter replied, with the deepest tragedy, Sir, you out see on low, call me not thus. Repeat that phrase and leave me. I am Napoleon, Emperor of France. ... Sir, you out see on, nothing daunted, proceeded to entertain him with an ordinance of the British government, regulating the state he should preserve, and the furniture of his rooms, and limiting his attendance to four or five persons. Four or five for me. ... said Napoleon. Me. 100,000 men were lately at my sole command, and this English officer talks of four or five for me. ... Throughout the piece, Napoleon,
who talked very like the real Napoleon, and was, forever, having small soliloquies by himself,
was very bitter on these English officers, ... and these English soldiers, to the great satisfaction of the audience, who were perfectly delighted to have Low bullied, and who, whenever Low said General Buonaparte,
which he always did, always receiving the same correction,
quite execrated him. It would be hard to say why, for Italians have little cause to sympathize with Napoleon, heaven knows. There was no plot at all, except that a French officer, disguised as an Englishman, came to propound a plan of escape, and being discovered, but not before Napoleon had magnanimously refused to steal his freedom, was immediately ordered off by Low to be hanged. In two very long speeches, which Low made memorable, by winding up with yaws, ... to show that he was English, which brought down thunders of applause. Napoleon was so affected by this catastrophe, that he fainted away on the spot, and was carried out by two other puppets. Judging from what followed, it would appear that he never recovered the shock, for the next act showed him, in a clean shirt, in his bed,
curtains crimson and white,
where a lady, prematurely dressed in mourning, brought two little children, who kneeled down by the bedside, while he made a decent end, the last word on his lips being Viterlo. Apostrophe, it was unspeakably ludicrous. Bilanopert's boots were so wonderfully beyond control, and did such marvelous things of their own accord. Doubling themselves up, and getting under tables, and dangling in the air, and sometimes skating away with him, out of all human knowledge, when he was in full speech missed chances which were not rendered the less absurd, by a settled melancholy depicted in his face. To put an end to one conference with Lo, he had to go to a table, and read a book. When it was the finest spectacle I ever beheld, to see his body bending over the volume, like a bootjack, and his sentimental eyes glaring obstinately into the pit. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.